My assignment this afternoon is one word, alcohol. There is no drug known in the world that is giving the world more trouble than ethyl alcohol. Alcohol is a word not found in the Bible, and that contributes to the confusion about it among believers in the Bible. When you and I read the word wine, many of us have a tendency to think of a drink with alcoholic content. But the word wine in the Bible does not necessarily denote and should not necessarily connote alcoholic content. The word wine is a generic expression. It applies to either non-alcoholic or alcoholic wine. And there's nothing in the word wine itself that tells us which it is. Wine, as a word, was used by the ancients of grape juice in all of its forms. There's nothing in the Bible that encourages social drinking. There's nothing in the Bible that encourages me to endorse social drinking. Far to the contrary. Everything we have in the Bible and my own observations for many years forced me to discourage you from the social drinking of alcohol. I see nothing to be gained by it, and I see many grave dangers in it. Liquor has hung more crepe, shed more blood, snapped more wedding rings, twisted more limbs, blinded more eyes, sold more homes, armed more villains, cheapened more women, shamed more fathers, murdered more victims, robbed more houses, and sent more people before God unprepared than all the plagues on earth since the days of Pharaoh. As a society, we make a product which is known to attack the powers of judgment. And then we complain that the people who use that product don't exercise judgment. Alcohol is a depressant. The very first thing depressed is the power of restraint, which most of us so seriously need. The impairment of discrimination begins with the very beginning of drinking. Indeed, this is usually the reason for drinking. People often drink to be able to say and do things that they otherwise would not have the guts to say and to do. Some impairment of the discriminating process occurs with any drinking at all, whether you even think you feel it or not. You may say, well, it doesn't feel like that to me. No, of course it doesn't. The drinker is in the worst possible position to make the decision about whether it's right to say a thing or not, whether it's good to do a thing or not, whether it's safe to drive or not. Alcohol is detectable in the brain 1/2 of a minute after being swallowed. Reaction times begin to be slowed immediately. This can be easily proven by driving simulation machines. Even when people don't think they're feeling it, their foot on the brake is slower than it would be if they hadn't had a drink. It immediately destroys, to some degree, our powers of discrimination. And physically speaking, some researchers say that every time you take a drink, you die a little because of the damage done irreparably. Alcohol is an addictive drug. No heroin user needs his heroin more than the alcoholic needs his bottle. Alcohol is often used to self-medicate underlying social and emotional and spiritual issues when we'd be better off facing and solving those issues on an emotional and spiritual level rather than just trying to mask them with drugs. The word wine is generic. It is ambiguous. The Lord said through the prophet Isaiah that new wine is found in the cluster, that is, in the cluster of grapes. The juice is called wine while it's still in the grape. There's obviously no alcoholic content there. Sometimes grapes in ancient times were even referred to as hanging wine. Aristotle spoke of sweet wine as wine in name, but not in effect. Another ancient author speaks of trampling the grapes and the new wine ran out over the road. He spoke of taking wine in from the fields. On the other hand, wine in passages like 1 Samuel 1:14, in the case of Hannah, where Eli was talking to her, wine obviously there is speaking of an intoxicating drink. So the word wine is used in both ways in the Bible. Alcoholic beverages are the result of fermentation. Fermentation is a process in which yeast cells act on the sugar content of fruit juice and convert that sugar to carbon dioxide and alcohol. Fermentation continues until all the sugar has been acted on by the yeast cells or until that fermenting mixture contains from 10 to 14% alcohol. At that point, the concentration of alcohol is enough to cause the yeast cells to stop their functioning. Natural fermentation cannot produce what modern people often drink for wine. A natural wine is only going to have about 12% alcohol, maybe not even that. But modern wines often contain from 20 to 24%. They've been fortified. When we look at the ancient literature on this subject, we find that fresh grape juice was called must. Yeast is a little fungus plant by which grape juice is fermented. A gallon of grape juice produces 50 gallons of carbon dioxide. It's quite an elaborate process to make drinkable alcoholic wine. It's much more of a chore to make alcoholic wine than it is to preserve the non-alcoholic grape juice. The idea that the ancient people had no alternative to drinking intoxicating wine is just not true. They were not quite as ignorant as a lot of people think they were. They knew how to prevent fermentation, and they did it in a number of ways. They did it by heat, they did it by cold, they did it by evaporation and by thickening, they did it by filtering. Pliny, in his Natural History, spoke of 91 different kinds of grapes, and he distinguished 50 different varieties of wine. He spoke of a certain wine that was still of the consistency of honey 2 centuries after it had been made. It had been preserved for 2 centuries. He used the word wine over and over and over again to refer to unfermented grape juice. The ancient people did not have to drink intoxicating wine. They made it because they wanted it. Nature does not make drinkable, intoxicating wine without human ingenuity giving her a helping hand. I'm stressing this because I've heard for many years that alcoholic wine practically makes itself, but that's not true. Call and ask a brewery if the alcoholic wine or beverage that they make makes itself, or if they have to work at it. Look at any of their commercials and see them brag about the skill and the know-how that they have exercised in order to make their product. Yeast are extremely sensitive to heat and cold. Yeast does its best work between 65 and 80 degrees Fahrenheit. When I worked in a donut shop, we kept our yeast in the refrigerator until we were ready to use it. And when we did use it, we put in water that had been heated to a precise temperature in order to activate that yeast. Boiling grape juice ensures that there is no fermentation. The preservation of grape juice was and is relatively simple. Boiling wine made the wine thicker. It depended on how much water was evaporated by the boiling. Some of it could be drunk straight, but often it had to be watered out of necessity, and sometimes even the sweet wines in ancient times were filtered. They were watered by a ratio of 20 to 1, 20 parts water to 1 part of the wine. Boiling ensured that if there was any alcoholic content, it was removed. Some of you may have cooked with alcoholic wine, and you know that the alcohol evaporates out very easily. As a matter of fact, ethyl alcohol evaporates at 173 degrees Fahrenheit. Water does not evaporate until 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's a 39-degree difference. Alcohol evaporates out of food 39 degrees sooner than even water does. Numerous of the ancient writers gave instructions so that the people could have grape juice all year long. Unfermented grape juice was in daily use by the ancient peoples year round. Now Genesis 40 verse 11 proves that grape juice was not unknown, even in very ancient, clear back in the patriarchal times. The butler took grapes and he pressed them into Pharaoh's cup, and then he gave the cup into Pharaoh's hand. There's no chance for fermentation there. Josephus, when he refers to this account, called that freshly expressed grape juice wine. And we could quote dozens of ancient and more recent authors showing that the word wine is applied to grape juice and other fruit juices in various stages. Boiling grape juice for 4 or 5 hours reduces it to 1/4 of the quantity that you started with, and then after it had thickened and much of the liquid was in the air, they would cool off the liquid and put it in earthen vessels and exclude the air, and it would stay fresh. It would stay fresh for an undetermined period of time. So the word wine settles nothing as to its inebriating or non-inebriating state. And in the Bible, 13 words are used to translate wine. And it's a little difficult to tell sometimes just what we're talking about. Context will not always tell us. Grapes could always be had at any time of year. They could be preserved. Josephus speaks of different fruits being laid up in the Masada against a siege. He said that they were ripe and not at all inferior to fresh fruits. And Josephus said they had been there, preserved like that in the Masada for 100 years. William Whiston, in his footnote, when he was translating Josephus, said that this strange testimony, nevertheless, coincides with the word of Pliny, that these people would keep grapes by hanging them in clusters from the ceiling of a room that was well closed, and that they would last an indefinite period of time. And grapes in ancient times were used for a lot of things, other than making alcoholic wine. They were eaten fresh, they were made into raisins. I could list you 16 things that grapes were used for. They even pickled grapes and ate them that way. Grape juice drinks and semi-solids were as common among the ancient people as coffee and tea are common among us today. Now, in a country like ours, where the vintage is often gathered, maybe in some places even chiefly for the purpose of making intoxicating wine, it's difficult to do justice to the language of Scripture, which extols the vine and its products. In modern parlance, I don't know of anything now that's called wine that's not intoxicating. Now, some of you are more adept at understanding the pop culture, and you may know of something that's called wine now that's not intoxicating. Personally, I don't, but I know that words change their meaning. There are places that you can go, and the word baptize means to sprinkle, but that's not what it originally meant. It's very important that we recognize the history of a word, because words often change their meaning. Sometimes they widen out, sometimes they narrow down. Any generic term is always open to becoming limited to a single meaning. But we must understand the Bible words as they were understood by the people that they were written to and who originally read them. It's a fallacy to claim that a word always means what it used to mean or that it means what it is most often used to mean. The question becomes, can we find any passage anywhere in the Bible where intoxicating beverages are approved by God? Can we find that? And if we can't find that, I think that creates a problem for the social drinker. And here's another thing that complicates it. The word drunken did not always mean intoxicated. It means, in its basic meaning, to drink to the full. Now, if what is drunk to the full is inebriating, then obviously the idea of intoxication is implied. But if it's not inebriating, then we're only talking about satiation when the word drunk or drunken is used. There is absolutely no moral dilemma involved in abstaining from alcohol, none whatsoever. Any view of this subject which creates a moral dilemma ought to be suspect and it ought to be investigated. I believe that the view that social drinking is approved by the Bible is such a view that it's suspect and it ought to be investigated. It ought to be investigated by each of you personally if you have an interest in this subject. When we take the negative on this, that we ought not to drink socially, we don't have to prove anything more than that what the affirmative says isn't true or isn't conclusive from the Bible. I'm not obviously going to have the time this afternoon to take the 13 words that the Bible uses for wine and all the context in which they're used. There is enough conflict among the scholars themselves on some of these words to warrant your own personal investigation of them. But I would like to, with the remaining time that I have, use a little, just look at a few of the commonly discussed passages in the Bible using some of these words. I'll start in Acts 2:13. These men are full of new wine. Now, the word here in the Greek is glucose. These men are full of glucose, new wine. Must we conclude from the jibe of the Jews against the apostles that glucose was intoxicating? I don't think so. Did Peter acknowledge by his answer that it was possible to be intoxicated by glucose? I don't think so at all. The ancient people were just as capable of sarcasm and irony as you and I are today. They could look at a drunk and say, well, it looks like he's had a little bit too much grape. Well, a grape itself isn't intoxicating, but you often hear these kinds of things said today. They've always been said. Looks like he's been hitting the grape juice. Yes, they thought that the apostles were intoxicated. It's clear from what Peter said in his response that that's what they thought. These men are not drunken, as ye suppose, he said. But that doesn't prove that glucose, new wine, was intoxicating. The mockers were probably, in my opinion, using sarcasm. It's as if they looked at these apostles and called them water drinkers. Somebody might look at a drunk and say, well, he's been at the medicine again. Well, sarcasm is used a lot of times in the Bible. In Ezekiel 28, verse 3, it said of the boss of Tyre on that occasion, oh, thou art wiser than Daniel. That's sarcastic. He wasn't really wiser than Daniel. If he had been, he wouldn't have been addressed in the way that he was. In Job 12 and 2, we have a very famous one. No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. That's extremely sarcastic. We do this today all the time. If somebody says something that's really obvious, we'll say, well, that's brilliant, Einstein. Somebody says something that everybody could see. Oh, that's really good, Sherlock. Give us another clue. What was your first clue on, you know? Peter's response to these people was based on the custom and the time of day. They're drunk or drunken in the night, said the Apostle Paul. He says it's only 9 o'clock in the morning. They're not drunken as you suppose. Remember that a thing may be forbidden in a passage without that thing being regarded as evil in itself. The Nazarites, for example, were forbidden from eating raisins. It didn't mean there was anything wrong with raisins. It was just that in their particular role, they weren't to eat them. They couldn't eat grapes, and there's no evil in a grape. How do we explain the fact that a word like yayin, Y-A-Y-I-N, which is one of the words translated wine in the Bible, how do we explain that it is said to be both a blessing and an evil? I think it's because of that intrinsic difference between unintoxicating and intoxicating wine, and yayin can refer to either one. One is the product of the life-giving God, the other is the result of decay and the art of man. One is a blessing, the other is a mocker, Proverbs 20, verse 1. And the same words are used to refer to both of them. That's what makes it confusing. Now, anything in excess is denounced in the Bible. Anything in excess, even honey. As an example, in Proverbs 25, verse 27, the statement is made there that it is not good to eat much honey. And if you've ever sat down and eaten too much honey, you know why it's not good to eat much honey. It's a little of it, it's wonderful in its place, but a little of it goes a long way. Contrast that with what is said in Proverbs 20 and verse 1 about wine. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whoso is deceived thereby is not wise. We don't hear anything about excess here. Rather, the thing itself is a mocker. If that passage in Proverbs 20 verse read instead of wine, if it read, crystal meth is a mocker, then we wouldn't hear the excess argument based on that. Crystal meth is a mocker does not mean that a little crystal meth is okay, but a lot is going to hurt you. I don't think there's anybody here. I hope there's nobody here this afternoon who thinks that a little crystal meth is okay. We need to think these things through. We ought to be students of the Bible and not just readers of what other people say about it. There's a word, tirash, which is translated wine. There are 38 appearances of it in the Bible, and there's only one place where there's any hint of any disapproval about it. Far from being intoxicated, it apparently is not even always a liquid. There's only one passage where it's associated with drinking at all, in the 62nd chapter of Isaiah. But in 2 Chronicles 31, tirash is said to be laid up in heaps. The passage in question is Hosea 4, verse 11. Whoredom and wine and new wine, whoredom and yayin and tirash, take away the understanding. Well, if whoredom takes away the understanding, then the understanding can be taken away without intoxication, right? If whoredom takes away the understanding can be taken away by things beside intoxication. At least that much is true. Furthermore, if yayin, the word translated here, which often describes intoxicating wine, takes away the understanding by intoxicating the individual, then if we're not careful, we have a needless repetition here between the yayin and the tirash. Long story short on that, there's no support at all for the idea that tirash is intoxicating wine. Another word, shekar, S-H-E-K-H-A-R, occurs 23 times. The King James renders it strong drink 21 times, but there's nothing in the Hebrew which corresponds to the word strong. Shekar may have always been intoxicating, I'm not sure. There's only two or three times where there's any question about its condemnation, though. 20 or 21 times it is explicitly condemned or associated with ungodliness. Think about this. In Leviticus chapter 10, the priests are told, this is right after the killing of Nadab and Abihu, the priests are told not to drink shikar, not to drink this wine, while officiating. I've heard people take that passage, and it's understandable superficially, but not when we look at it in depth, for somebody to take that passage and say, well, since the priests were told not to drink shikar while they were officiating, that necessarily infers that it was approved when they were not officiating. I deny that. I don't think there's any necessary inference there at all. And we're in trouble if we think that there is. In Proverbs 23, verse 22, the statement is made there, despise not thy mother when she is old. Does that necessarily infer that it's okay to despise your mother when she's young? Of course not. None of us would think that. It is often asked, though, why would God forbid shikar when the priests were officiating unless it was approved when they weren't? We could come back with the same question. Why would God forbid the despising of your mother when she's old unless it is approved when she's young? Why is it that a bishop is told that he can't have more than one wife, unless it was acceptable for non-bishops in the church to have more than one wife? Deacons are not to be given to much wine. Does this imply that others in the church may be given to much wine? We may say to a young man, as long as you represent Jesus in the capacity of an evangelist, be sure and pay your bills and be honest. Can we say that to him without implying that he has the right to be dishonest if he ceases to be an evangelist? Of course we can. Why would God forbid something at a specific time, which he always forbids, merely to stress the sacredness of the work? If we describe a situation during the announcements and we ask the brethren to pray fervently about this matter, does that mean that we are not interested in the brethren praying fervently about any number of other matters? Of course it doesn't. We're simply stressing the importance of a particular issue. The word shikar in Leviticus 10 verse 9 is either intoxicating or it's non-intoxicating. It's one or the other. If it's intoxicating, it is not implicitly approved by the prohibition during a specific job. If it's non-intoxicating, then it's forbidden only to stress the sacredness of that job. While we're talking about the priest and the temple services, we ought not to be misled by any arguments regarding the drink offering. We're on fairly safe ground, biblically speaking, if we say that the drink offering was not drunk. The drink offering was not drunk. The drink offering was poured out to the Lord, just like David pouring out the water from Bethlehem that his soldiers had gotten at great cost. The drink offering was poured out to the Lord, so whether it was alcoholic or not, it was not for human consumption. Now, what about Proverbs 31, verse 7? Give strong drink unto him that is ready to perish. Now, this may have been speaking medicinally, as though this was going to be used as anesthesia in the days when we had not developed a number of the drugs that we have now. That's one possible view of this passage. Or it may mean, leave strong drink to them that are ready to perish, rather than give it to them in an imperative way. Actually, there are a lot of imperatives in the Bible that are not really imperatives at all. They're merely saying things because you know that people are going to do them anyway. Jesus did this to the Pharisees in the 23rd chapter of the book of Matthew, verse 32. Fill ye up then the cup of your fathers. In other words, I know what you're going to go ahead and do anyway, so that thou doest do quickly. That same type of thing. He wasn't really urging them to do it, but he was speaking to them in light of their own principles and telling them to do what it was their nature to do. Same thing that we have in Ecclesiastes 11, verse 9, urges a young man there to do his thing. You go on out and do your thing, sow your wild oats and do all that, but bear in mind that God is going to bring you into judgment for all of that. That's what he says there. So he's not really encouraging you to do your thing and sow your wild oats, even though he says those words. Same thing in Isaiah chapter 50, verse 11. God urging the Israelites there to walk in the light of their own man-made fires and bear the consequences of that. He doesn't really want them to do it, even though he says, do it. So if strong drink is to be drunk, it's to be left to those who are about to die. I think that's all we can make out of Proverbs 31 and verse 7. Let's go to the Lord's statement about the new wine in the new wineskins. Whatever is put into the new wineskin must be unfermented, or the whole story loses its point. The new wine was put in the skin in order to keep it from fermenting. Not to allow for fermentation, but to keep it from fermenting. They'd put it in the new skin, and then they'd seal it up to keep the air out. I know it wasn't put in there to be fermented, or you would have lost every wineskin. The expansive power of carbonic gas is just amazing. One cubic inch of sugar transformed into carbonic gas takes about 40 times as much room as the sugar did. Fermenting liquids have been known to burst wooden barrels that have metal hoops around them. A gallon of grape juice produces 40 to 50 gallons of carbon dioxide when it's converting into ethyl alcohol. There are very few sealed containers which could keep from bursting under those kind of conditions. When fermentation was sought, it was sought in a vat and not in the wineskins. As a matter of fact, in Job 32, verse 19, it shows what happens when, through carelessness, new wine that has been permitted to begin to ferment is put into new wineskins. It swells up and it's ready to burst, and unless it's open and the gas released, then it will burst. So Jesus, in talking about the wine in the wineskins, assumes the sealing of the skin. He couldn't have been talking about an unsealed skin, because that would have had no danger of bursting whether it was old or new. It wouldn't matter whether the skin was old or new. It would ferment, and just the gas would just escape because the wineskin was not sealed. To put new wine in old wineskins was bad because they had the dregs. After they had been opened and the wine poured out and there was still wine on the inside and the air had gotten in and they would begin a fermentation process then, just in the dregs that were left in the bag. And that was the reason you couldn't use them to put new wine in, because that those fermented dregs were already there. Wineskins were the work of tanneries, and they were treated to be somewhat antiseptic. The tanning process itself inhibited fermentation. Winemakers say that if you make the container antiseptic, you can prevent fermentation. Also, if you put a little liquid sulfur in the grape juice, it won't ferment. If you burn a sulfurized strip of cloth under a container before putting the grape juice into it, it won't ferment. And the ancient people had investigated this. They did all of those things. Let's go to Cana of Galilee in John chapter 2. The man at the wedding feast there said, when men have well drunk, not when men have got drunk. That often gets read, when men have got drunk, but that isn't what he said. When men have well drunk. The ASV, which often hits the nail on the head so strongly, the American Standard Version of 1901 says, when men have drunk freely. And that is apparently exactly what the man at the wedding feast said. This word often means satiated. It means full. It's much broader than just the word intoxicated. I could give you numerous examples of that if I had time. As a matter of fact, the English word drunk, our English word drunk, did not always mean intoxicated either. Now, in the 21st century, it does. That's exactly what it means, and that's all it means now. But it didn't always mean intoxicated. It was often used in early writers to mean sated or satiated or full. So in the Greek or in the English, these words speak of satiation, which may or may not include intoxication. If what was consumed to the full is intoxicating, then obviously they imply intoxication. But if it wasn't, then they simply describe a satiation. Jacinius, talking about the Hebrew word shakar, and shaker and the Hebrew equivalent, methuo, he defines these as to drink to the full. As a sideline in 1 Corinthians 11:21, one is hungry and another is drunken. Paul's talking about the Lord's Supper and the eating the meal and so forth in the city of Corinth. One is hungry and another is drunken. He's talking about opposites there. Again, the idea another is drunken in the King James Bible is that they are filled or satiated, not necessarily intoxicated at all, because we're talking about opposites. One is hungry and another is just as full as he can be. Can you really believe the brethren at Corinth were getting drunk around the Lord's Supper and Paul didn't hone in on that particular thing? I can't. Now, even if in Corinth they had used intoxicating wine in the Lord's Supper, it wouldn't have been certain that the Lord approved it, since the Corinthians did so many other things of which the Lord did not approve. But back to John 2, which is what I was trying to talk about. If the man at the wedding feast had intoxication in mind, that still wouldn't prove that Jesus made intoxicating wine. Bear in mind, Jesus had 6 stone water pots, and they had 2 or 3 firkins of capacity to them apiece. That means that when those were filled, they were filled up to the brim, remember, and Jesus turned all of that water into wine, that he made 123.6 to 185.4 gallons of something. He turned that much water, that's a lot of water, into that much wine of some content, some kind of wine that he made out of that. If the man at the wedding feast had intoxication in mind when he was talking, that still wouldn't prove that Jesus made intoxicating wine. It would only establish what the man was used to seeing at a wedding feast. But Jesus didn't do what that man was used to seeing. Jesus did better than what that man had ever seen. That's why he was making the comment. It's common sense, isn't it, to put the best of everything first, whether we're talking about food or drink. You would hope that a large helping of the best would satisfy people so that you wouldn't need to bring out the inferior product later. That's the idea. And that's what the head of the feast was saying. He's saying the first was great, but the later was even better. You know what Pliny said the best wine was? Pliny said that the best wine was unadulterated and freshly kept grape juice. And I think that's my personal opinion, that that's exactly what the Lord made. When men have drunk freely, they don't feel like drinking more. You know that. You probably don't feel like eating too much right now, do you, most of you? When people have eaten abundantly, they don't wish for more. Food doesn't even look good after we've eaten like we did, does it? They'd all be full. They'd not be inclined to eat or drink further. And it's not at all impossible in my mind that one could drink so much grape juice that you might not be able to taste the difference between good grape juice and inferior grape juice. In short, what do we need? What do we need to show that the wine in John chapter 2 was inebriating? More than we've got, that's the answer. We need more than we've got to prove that the wine in John chapter 2 was inebriating. I can't prove it. I couldn't begin to prove that it was inebriating wine. As a matter of fact, John chapter 2 verse 11 says that this beginning of his signs did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory. Did our Lord manifest his glory by making enough gallons of wine that was alcoholic for people to get drunk on at a wedding feast? Is that what he did in manifesting his glory? I don't think so. We don't need to come to that conclusion. John seems bent on showing that whatever Moses did, Jesus did better. Moses built a tabernacle for God to dwell in. Jesus was the tabernacle that God dwelt in. Moses brought the law. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Moses saw a representation of the Lord. Jesus exegeted God. Moses wrote of the Messiah. Jesus was the Messiah. Moses showed signs, his first being water to blood. Jesus showed signs, his first being water to the blood of the grape. I think that's all it was. The blood of the grape, wonderful, healthful grape juice. Romans 14:21. It is good neither to eat flesh, nor to drink wine, nor to do anything whereby thy brother stumbleth. This passage is often quoted to show that the Christian has the liberty to drink intoxicating drinks, but for the sake of others, he should forego that liberty. But that begs the question, I believe, to make that conclusion. To put the social consumption of intoxicating drink in the realm of liberty, which a saint ought to forego, is assuming the thing to be proven. Notice here that what Paul says of wine, he also says of flesh and of any other thing. Even if we knew for sure that the wine in Romans 14:21 was not intoxicating, Paul still could have said exactly what he said here. There's nothing at all in Romans 14:21 that demands intoxicating drink to be meant by Paul. If he was talking about intoxicating drink, how would we know that he was? There's no basis for concluding that he was, because he says the same thing about the meat that he says about the wine. And eating and drinking covers the whole area. There was nothing about the constitution of the meat that made it offensive, and we have no reason to suggest that there was something offensive in the constitution of the wine. There's no way to restrict the wine of Romans 14:21 to any special kind of wine. We can't, therefore, assume, based on Romans 14:21, that drinking intoxicating drinks is a liberty. His point is that whatever leads the sincere to stumble should be forfeited. And we're talking here about the issue of influence in Romans 14. And we need to emphasize the issue of influence with regard to alcohol, because it is a big issue with regard to alcohol. My dad was not a drinker, so far as I know. And if he had, I know that it would have had an influence, probably a very pernicious influence, on me. I didn't have the excuse that his drinking would have given me. I remember the first time when, as a boy, I went to a friend's house and his father was drunk. And it was not a pretty picture. I had never seen anything like that in my house. My friend smoked marijuana because he said that that was the equivalent of what his father was doing with alcohol. I told him that my dad didn't drink, so the equivalent for me of that was not smoking marijuana. And I think this is important, because I came up in the 60s, and it wouldn't have taken much of an excuse for me to just get dabble in drugs and then be gone on drugs. If my dad had been a drinker, I don't know where I'd be today. I probably wouldn't be here. I might not be living on earth anymore. I very much appreciate the good examples that we have had of brethren who have lived lives of sobriety over the decades. Alcohol is often used to try to influence people, to give you information they wouldn't otherwise give you, or to do things for you and with you that they would not otherwise do. You remember the crude old saying in the bars, don't you? When men are trying to influence women, candy is dandy, but liquor's quicker. And that is absolutely true. A man may walk into a bar and he doesn't even see a woman that appeals to him, but after a few drinks, every woman in the place appeals to him, because his discriminating power is going down, down, down. And that may be why he is drinking. There's a lot to be said about influence. Even if influence here was the only issue, it should be enough to give us pause on this issue. But let's cover another scripture here. Ephesians 5:18. Ephesians 5:18, be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess. It has been said that since Paul is condemning drunkenness, there is an implicit approval of moderate use. But think of a scripture like Ecclesiastes 7:17, which says, be not overmuch wicked. Does be not overmuch wicked suggest the approval of wickedness in moderation? Of course it doesn't. Could you urge a man, Don't get drunk on whiskey. Find your satisfaction in Jesus without intending the approval of the moderate drinking of whiskey. Of course you could. I've heard some of you do that. If you could do that today, then why couldn't Paul do it in the first century? Be not drunk with wine does not mean wine is okay in moderation. Any more than be not guilty of greedy of filthy lucre suggests the approval of an inclination toward filthy lucre. Couldn't we say to somebody, don't get stoned on drugs, without implying that we approve of the temperate use of drugs? Couldn't we urge a man to avoid drunkenness without approving moderate drinking? Indeed, we could. Couldn't we say to somebody, stop this incessant lying, without meaning that occasional lying will be all right? Don't be addicted to wine is not an approval of moderate drinking, any more than don't be a slave enslaved to sin is an approval of moderate sinning. Be not given to much wine. Ramsey tells us about drinking bouts that were held for prizes. It wasn't an issue of intoxication at all. The wine that was used for this was not intoxicating. It was just a contest to see who could drink the most. That shouldn't surprise you. We have a Guinness Book of World Records that's full of the results of these kind of contests today. Who can eat the most ice cream? Who can eat the most hot dogs? And people are very proud sometimes of their world records. Here's drinking where intoxication was not the aim, but there would be prizes, sometimes substantial prizes given for the volume drunk. So the deacons were going from house to house with food and drink for the needy, and there was every opportunity for a deacon to become known as a wine addict, somebody who can drink a great deal of wine. In the same way, I've known evangelists who were known for their prodigious appetites, how much food that they could get put away. They could go to one person's house and eat a massive meal there, and I've been one of these guys. Go to the next house, not so much anymore, I just can't do it anymore, but go to the next house and just eat a prodigious meal there. If a deacon happened to be a convert from a background of prize-winning drinking contests, then the warning was needed, not given to much wine. Here's an interesting thing. In 1 Timothy 3:3 and Titus 1:7, they speak of the bishop as no brawler, no striker. The word literally means near wine, because he was not to be one who partied. These parties often ended in fights. In fact, the ASV footnote here suggests not violent over wine. But I need to get on here. 1 Timothy 5:23. 1 Timothy 5:23 tells Timothy, be no longer a drinker of water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine oft infirmities. Paul tells the young man to use a little wine. Now who knows why apparently Timothy had avoided all wine prior to this. Maybe he wanted to avoid the possibility of drinking intoxicating wine, so he just avoided it all. The use of the word use here instead of the word drink, I think, stresses the medicinal thrust of this passage. As a matter of fact, an ancient author by the name of Athenaeus writes of a man with stomach trouble and says, let him take sweet wine as good for the stomach, for sweet wine does not make the head heavy. Sweet wine, the specific word he uses there is referring to the sweet grape juice that flows from the press even before the grapes begin to be trodden. You pile a bunch of grapes up, just the weight of the top grapes on the bottom grapes is going to press some juice out of them. That's what he's talking about here. Fresh grape juice. There's a medicinal thrust here. And the Welch's grape juice people have always been able to give you information on the healthful aspects of grape juice and its tremendous nutritional value. In the 1950s, my grandfather, my father's father, told me that he believed that grape juice had once saved his life when he thought he was dying as a young man. If 1 Timothy 5:23 was really speaking of intoxicating wine, would that give us the right to drink socially? I don't think so. Any more than if a man told me that it's acceptable to use drugs for social pleasure because they're used in hospitals as medicine. Would I believe that? No, I don't think I would believe that. He's talking here medicinally, if I understand 1 Timothy 5:23. For thine oft infirmities and for thy stomach's sake. Even if it is alcoholic, and I can't begin to prove that it is, because grape juice would be good for you under those conditions as well. Titus 2, verse 3. The women not given to much wine. Grape juice was chiefly used in antiquity as a casual drink of the peasantry, and when it was carefully preserved as the choice beverage of the Epicureans. The Roman ladies were so fond of it that they would get their stomachs filled with it, and then they would take something to make them vomit it up so they could have the pleasure of drinking themselves full all over again. It's not a pretty picture, but they got in the habit of this, and it didn't bother them at all. They would eat and drink grape juice, and then vomit it up to fill themselves again. Lucian, an ancient author, speaks of those who drink glucose swelling out their stomach and requiring an emetic to vomit. It's not really clear, historically speaking, what the more common drink was, fermented wine or unfermented wine. You read people that say one thing, you read people that say the opposite. If Jesus used the common drink at the Passover, it does not at all follow that he used intoxicating wine. We don't know for sure what was there, but I think he used non-intoxicating wine because I have a problem with Jesus Christ drinking 3 pints of alcoholic wine at one sitting. The Talmud said that every person partaking of the Passover must drink 4 cups of wine, even the very poor. If they couldn't afford it, we'd make it available to them at public expense. Now think about this. Leaven was forbidden at the Passover. We were reminded of that in this morning. Leaven was forbidden at the Passover. And the ferment in bread and the ferment in wine is chemically the same. Now, it's true that when the Bible talks about the leaven in this matter, bread is always the thing under consideration. That's not surprising because wine was not a part of the original Passover feast anyway. If unleavened bread was the only bread to be eaten because it reflected the haste with which they left Egypt, then what about unfermented wine? Grape juice doesn't begin to ferment immediately on leaving the grape, and so you could make the same point by using unfermented grape juice rather than a fermented wine. Whatever the reason was for excluding the fermentation of the bread, the same principle would seem to exclude the same thing in anything else. But I want to stress the Bible does not explicitly settle this issue. What we're sure of is this. Leaven was forbidden. Leaven was forbidden in their bread. Leaven was forbidden in their houses. It would seem strange to me that if they had to remove all that was fermented, but then they could turn around and drink a pint and a half of fermented wine. In the later historical allusions to this meal, there's no mention of the wine, but it is thought that the wine in the Passover came in sometime after the Babylonian captivity. The leavening process was a well-known and often spoken of symbol of corruption. We've had that mentioned by 2 different speakers already today. It was a symbol of corruption. Whereas the blood of Jesus Christ was pure, and it seems more aptly set forth in unfermented grape juice. I know that it's possible to preserve this and use it that way. My grandparents grew grapes and we bottled that, and that was used in the Lord's Supper in the church at Bremer for many, many years. And it would stay good in the bottles for a year. We wrote the dates on the bottles, and some of those bottles were getting pretty old, but they weren't fermented at all when we took the tops off of them. It's a remarkable thing to me, while we're on this subject, that the Lord uses the expression fruit of the vine in Matthew 26:29, when the word oinos, translated wine, is so handy. But he takes the trouble to say fruit of the vine instead of just saying oinos. That expression, this is the only place in the New Testament, that it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but this is the only occasion in the New Testament where the phrase fruit of the vine is used in the New Testament anywhere. In fact, it only occurs 6 other times in the Bible at all in the Septuagint, of course. Out of the 7 occurrences of this phrase in the Bible, 6 of them deal with a solid substance and not with a liquid at all. I think Jesus was using the fruit of the vine metonymically, in other words, talking about the grapes, naming the grapes when really the juice of the grape was in view. I believe it is the responsibility of the pro-drinker to establish that Jesus used intoxicating wine. And if you take that position, I'll be more interested in your evidence than I am in your conclusion. If it cannot be proven that Jesus socially imbibed intoxicating wine, then no argument can be made in support of the pro-drinking position based on the conduct of Jesus. Remember, there's no moral difficulty in Jesus drinking fresh grape juice, none whatsoever. And the scriptures allow for that. There is a difficulty in Jesus drinking alcoholic grape juice in much quantity, and in also giving alcoholic wine to the tune of almost 200 gallons, perhaps, to people to get drunk on. I have to stop, but just let me ask you 4 questions that you should consider. Any Bible scripture that you look at on this subject, ask yourself 4 questions. Number 1, am I certain that the wine in this passage is intoxicating? Am I certain that God is approving of its use? Am I certain that God is approving of it for human consumption? Am I certain that God is approving of it for human consumption as a social pleasure, as distinct, say, from a medicinal use? If you're not certain of those things, then you're not certain that God approves of the social drinking of alcoholic drinks. And if you're not certain of it, then don't teach that God approves of it. Liquor is built with a drug in it that by its very nature takes away our ability to live so soberly, righteously, godly in this present world. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whoso erreth thereby, whoso is deceived thereby, is not wise. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it moveth itself aright. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor to drink.